Matter before the court is the case of Robinson versus USAA. Good morning, counsel. While you are getting settled, I will remind you that you each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. It's important that you both state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, because we are recording these for our records. And with that, when you are ready, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning again. My name is William French. I'm the attorney for appellants John and Marguerite Robinson. May it please the court, Mrs. Avinsky, I'd also like the record to reflect that Mr. Robinson is here today as well. This is an appeal from an order, not a judgment. And in our world, those two events are vastly different. I mean, there's some crossover here, because there's an issue about post-judgment interest and so on and so forth. So we talk about both interests, but I want to emphasize, this is an appeal from an order. So there's. Let me address the jurisdictional issue first. It's been my experience, going back a ways, that if there's a jurisdictional issue, the leading experts in Minnesota on appellate procedure are at the appellate courts, and they will identify it right off the bat. That was not done in this case. It's not dispositive by any means, but I just point that out. I think it's worth noting.
Nor was there a motion to dismiss the appeal.
Correct. This appeal was taken under 103.03 sub E. It's a very succinct grant of jurisdiction for an order which in effect determines the action and prevents a judgment from which an appeal might be taken. Now, I've addressed this not at great length, but in my reply brief. And I think a key, there appears to be no case directly on point here, but I think we have to look at the word determine. What does that really mean? Don't know if there are any Latin speakers here today, but it's based on a word determinare in Latin. It means to limit or fix. And if you put that in for determine in this action, in order which in effect limits the action and prevents a judgment from which an appeal might be taken. The decision in this case limited the judgment, determined the judgment, and obviously you don't add a judgment to a judgment, so there's no judgment that was entered on this. So this order, our position is clearly appealable. Then we move on to section of the appellate rules 108.01 paren 2. Did the court have jurisdiction to rule on this issue, on this motion?
Well, and then we get to the point of does that affect the matter on appeal, or is it collateral? And it seems to me, I mean, the issue in the case, which our court decided in the direct appeal, if you will, had to do with the appraisal award itself. How did this order concerning the deposit of the appraisal award amount, how did that affect the appeal that was pending before our court?
It didn't, Your Honor.
So wouldn't that be make it a collateral matter that the district court would have jurisdiction to address while the main appeal is pending?
Your Honor, I've had sort of an insight. You know, sometimes it takes a while in these cases. I was just sitting here listening to the previous argument, quite complicated. This one appears much more simple. But the rule is, and in this case, nothing has been done subsequent to the entry of the order that is independent of, supplemental to, or collateral to the order appealed from. Not from the judgment appealed from. This is an order that was appealed from. So we use this expression all the time in English. It's become very popular. The order is what it is. There was nothing done that was independent of the order that was appealed.
And we're talking about the order of confirming the appraisal award. That was the order, or was that a judgment that was appealed?
It was in the first action that was a judgment.
Okay, so the question is this order permitting USAA to deposit the amount awarded by the appraisers into court, is that collateral to the judgment appealed from?
No, I don't believe it is. It's the order. In this case, it's an order that was appealed, not a judgment.
But the order was for confirmed the appraisal award, though, correct?
No. In this case, all this order that's before this court today is about the post-judgment interest. There was another appeal on the judgment.
The depositing the money into court.
That's the sole issue. Doesn't have anything to do with the original judgment other than adding interest.
So isn't that the point? Wasn't the district court within its authority? Because, in fact, that had nothing to do with the appraisal award itself and the appeal challenging the appraisal award.
I disagree with Judge Borkman, because in this case we have to look precisely or limit our inquiry to what was appealed in this case. Simply an order. A judgment wasn't appealed here. It was an order. We don't look to the other case that was appealed.
But I thought you just expressed the position that one has nothing to do, I think those are your words, nothing to do with the judgment.
Well, it does have something to do with the judgment itself, but not with the judgment appealed from in the other case that's already been decided by this court. But a petition for review, further review, has been filed with the Supreme Court. So our position is that the order appealed from here, there was nothing added to it. The order simply says, the judge said we're simply going to limit the post-judgment interest.
So let's assume you're right that this order was an appealable order, and so now we're looking at your appeal from the order. The order permitting USAA to deposit the money into court. So let's assume that's an appealable order. I think your argument is that the district court didn't have jurisdiction to enter that order. And I think my question is, why not? If you have told us that the decision to permit USAA to put the money into court had nothing to do with the underlying judgment, so why didn't the district court have the authority?
Because we have to look at Rule 108.01 sub 2. Nothing was, the court didn't do anything that was independent of, supplemental to, or collateral to the order that we were appealing from.
You mean the judgment? The main appeal was from the judgment, right? Did we?
Well, in this case, it was simply an order. We were appealing from an order.
Yes. But the question is whether, the issue is whether, as you've put it to us, whether the district court could even enter this order, whether it had jurisdiction, right, to consider the motion to deposit the money. And my question is, why not? Why didn't have authority? You've pointed us to Rule 108.01 Subdivision 2, which directs our analysis to the question of whether this motion to deposit the money was collateral to the judgment appealed from.
Well, I guess,
right?
I mean,
isn't that what Rule 108.01 does?
Well, I'm looking at it in a more limited fashion to this case is simply about an order. So did the trial court have authority to do this? I don't believe so. There was no authority, because not only did the court eliminate future post-judgment interest, but the trial court also took away a post-judgment interest that had occurred during the period of May 27, 22 to October 6, 22.
So it sounds like you're really challenging the merits of the decision, not the court's authority to make a decision.
Well, it's kind of both, really. I'm just pointing that out, that how can a court do this? This is the money of the Robinsons.
When you say it's kind of both, your argument, your appeal in this case is couched purely in jurisdictional terms. It's the authority of the court that you're challenging, the authority of the district court that you're challenging.
Correct.
But you're basing it on the merits.
Well, I think the court has to look at what the trial court really did in this case.
Don't we just have to look at the rule that you've cited and measure the relationship between the order and the judgment?
Well, if the trial court had jurisdiction to hear this motion, then certainly this court has the authority to look at what the court did, doesn't it?
But you're not asking us to. You're asking us to look at whether the district court, your challenge is to the district court's authority to enter the order after the judgment. If I read your brief right, and you know, if you're relying nicely on Albert Camus, and you know, brevity is important, and it can be persuasive. But if you've cut off an argument, we don't look to that argument that you didn't make. We look at the argument that you presented.
Well, but I think in the reply brief I did make that argument, Judge Ross.
But the reply brief isn't a basis of an appeal. We don't look to arguments that are presented in a reply brief. We look only at the moving brief to frame. It wouldn't be fair otherwise if you could sandbag and wait. If an appellate can sandbag and wait and say, aha, now we've got you on an argument we hadn't yet presented. So based on your appeal, aren't we looking at the court's jurisdiction only?
Judge Ross, I think you're right. I think it's strictly a jurisdictional argument. The court didn't have authority to rule on this motion because there was an appeal underway. And taking this argument a little step further, was what the court did independent of supplemental to or collateral really to the previous judgment?
Correct. And so then the question is how it's supplement your argument. My understanding of your argument is that it was not supplemental to the judgment because granting the motion changed the judgment. How did allowing a deposit of money after a judgment had been entered, how does that change that underlying judgment?
Well, number one, it adds to it. But in this case, the judge also eliminated post-judgment interest. And the judge is removing.
But it doesn't affect the underlying judgment itself. The judgment has already been entered. We're just talking post-judgment interest, which is what parties often do. Say, okay, one party or the other or both may appeal, but we're going to put deposit money with the court so that basically tolls the accruing of post-judgment interest. I'm struggling with how that affects the underlying judgment itself. The judgment has already been decided. Judgment has already been made.
Correct.
How is the decision of depositing money, how does that affect or change the underlying judgment?
Well, number one, it increases it, so it alters it in that sense. In this case, I personally think it's very significant.
What case law?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sure, I think you anticipated my question. What case law supports that position?
You know, I always criticize people for interrupting me. I always criticize witnesses to start talking before the question is finished, and I'm doing it myself.
Not a problem.
But anyways, it's affecting the judgment in the sense that any future post-judgment interest has been eliminated till the ending of time, really. And also, to look more deeply into this, the trial court, without any explanation, simply took money that was due the Robinsons and eliminated it.
How did it eliminate that money?
Because they would have been entitled to post-judgment interest from the date of the judgment, which was May 24th, 22. They would be entitled to that till the date of this judge's decision, but the judge only gave them 3 days of interest from May 24th to May 27th without really any explanation. She took away 132 days of interest.
But that's different than the underlying judgment itself. And you cite in your reply brief the Morix case and to support your argument that the district court had tampered with the judgment while an appeal is pending and created a legal mess. That case is, first of all, it's not precedential, so it's not binding. But I didn't see where that case supports that proposition at all.
What case was that, Your Honor?
Sure, the Marks case.
Was that in my main brief or the?
No, it was in your reply brief.
Thank you.
And my apologies, it's at the very end. It's actually in footnote 5.
I see.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure, Your Honor.
I had a difficult time with the equities of this case. So it feels like, so your client gets a judgment. The insurer says, okay, we'll pay the judgment. And your client says no. I mean, usually post-judgment interest is in order to encourage payment. Here we've got the defendant tendering payment. And instead, your client says no, and we're going to appeal, and we're going to raise issues according to the other decision by a different panel of this court. We're going to appeal based upon issues we haven't even raised in the district court. And as I understand it, there's also a petition for further review, if I'm not mistaken, in that
case.
That's
correct.
So effectively, your client is in a position to have accepted the judgment, and instead, you would want your client to be able to delay the acceptance of that payment while additional amounts are being accrued against the defendant. I'm trying to get a sense of how the equities favor your position. Maybe it doesn't matter. You're arguing just on the rule. But if we look beyond the rule at the purpose of it, how does this circumstance at all align with the purpose of the rule?
Well, number one, if my clients took the money, their case is over.
Not necessarily. I mean, you could have an agreement you could offer an agreement. I don't think there's nothing in the record to suggest that, well, okay, we'll accept payment, but on these conditions that it's not a full satisfaction. That could have happened, right?
It could have happened. I thought of it, but decided not to do it because I thought it was a waste of time to even ask for that. But anyways, my time is up.
And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alexandra Zabinski, and I represent respondent USAA. This court should dismiss this matter because the Robinsons failed to timely seek discretionary review. But in the alternative, it should affirm the district court's order because district courts have jurisdiction to rule on collateral issues while an appeal is pending.
In terms of the jurisdiction, I am surprised. Mr. French is not wrong. I mean, usually jurisdiction kind of challenges are raised either by the court or upon motion of a responding party. How do you explain the lack of a motion here, and how does that affect your jurisdictional argument, if at all?
Jurisdictional is to this court, not
right.
The district court.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. To be honest, I don't recall the reason a motion wasn't brought earlier. But there's no requirement in this court's appellate rules that a motion be filed in order to raise a jurisdictional challenge. And we see decisions from this court all the time that say failure to file a timely appeal, or in this case, failure to timely seek discretionary review, is a jurisdictional barrier. So whether or not a motion was filed, that's a separate issue from whether the court has jurisdiction, right? And the court does not have jurisdiction over untimely appeals, or in this case, matters where discretionary review was not timely sought. Now, the court's pretty familiar with the language of Rule 103.03e. I'm not going to exhaustively go through the difference between 103.03e and 105, but I will just point out for the record, this court's appellate rules sort orders into two buckets, right? There are appealable orders listed in 103.03, and there's everything else which proceeds under Rule 105.
Why wouldn't this order, which comes from a Rule 67 motion to deposit, right, or interpleader, which I think falls under sort of special proceedings in the civil appellate or the rules of civil procedure. So why wouldn't we construe this to be an appealable order under 103.03 sub G that talks about final orders or decisions in administrative or other special proceedings?
I haven't seen any case law saying it is a special proceeding, Your Honor. And when our state Supreme Court adopted Rule 103.03, it listed the orders that it wanted to be appealable. It could have listed orders pursuant to Rule 67. It could have said all post-judgment orders, and it didn't do that. It listed a specific category of post-judgment orders, right, orders that are supplementary to execution, I think, but it left out the broader category of something like this where there's no judgment being executed on. It's just a post-judgment order where the defendant's actually trying to deposit the funds.
And so if in your mind it's not an appealable order, is it an argument that that the Robinsons would be able to make when the appeal that's now up before our Supreme Court is finally resolved?
No, they needed to seek discretionary review, and they didn't do that. And that's, I think, an important thing to focus on here. The Robinsons don't have some undue hardship where they have no avenue for appeal. They just have a shorter timeline, and they need to be diligent in pursuing their appeal rights under Rule 105. Rule 105 says they needed to file their petition for review within 30 days of the underlying order, and they failed to do that. And that's the end of the story. This court can't extend the deadline to seek discretionary review, right? That's in Rule 126.02. And Rule 126.02 expressly references not just notices of appeal, but requests for review of a lower court's order. So the deadline's passed. It can't be extended. The Robinsons can't be here. And I'll just refer the court to the Cashman case, which we cited footnote 39 of our brief, where the Minnesota Supreme Court addressed an untimely, a case that should have been submitted via a petition for discretionary review, and it wasn't timely submitted. And the Minnesota State Supreme Court said, the case is over. We can't address this matter because that deadline has passed. So that the same result that occurred in Cashman should occur here. This matter should be dismissed.
If we disagree with you and get to the merits, if you will, of the appeal of this particular order, why should we conclude that this order, which will govern how much judgment is ultimately collectible, right, by the appellants, why that wouldn't relate to the judgment on appeal?
I'm going to respectfully disagree with a couple points of your premise, Judge Bjorkman. First of all, it does relate to the judgment on appeal, right? But that's not the standard for whether a district court retains jurisdiction over a matter while there's pending appeal. It's not whether there's a relation. It's whether the issue is collateral. So the district court retains jurisdiction over collateral issues, and I'll talk about what that means in a moment. But the other issue I want to quickly address, I guess I forgot that point. I'll come back to it hopefully if it comes back to my mind. So turning to what's a collateral issue, right? So Rule 108.01 sub 2 says that the district court retains jurisdiction over collateral issues. The Minnesota Supreme Court has explained what that term means, and this is in the Spaeth case that we cited footnote 52 of our brief. Issues that are collateral are those that are not necessarily implicated or necessarily involved on appeal. And in this case, the Robinsons didn't raise any challenges to the two issues that we asked the district court to address: the time frame over which post-judgment interest would accrue, and the manner for paying the judgment to the Robinsons. Instead, the issues raised on appeal, and this is in their statement of the case, it's document 77 in the record, were the following. Broadly speaking, they didn't like the fact that there was a judgment, so they said you should have brought a summary judgment motion, the district court should have delayed the hearing, and the district court should have asked the parties if they wanted other issues decided. And the Robinsons said they didn't like the amount of the judgment, they wanted pre-judgment interest, and they didn't like the perceived treatment of a pro se filing by John Robinson. Those were the issues raised on appeal. None of those issues has anything to do with the manner of paying the judgment or the time frame over which post-judgment interest would accrue. So it's that simple. The issues on appeal had very little to do with the issues that the district court was asked to address, and there was no necessary effect by the district court ruling on the time frame for post-judgment interest or the manner of paying the judgment.
Was there any discussion in the tender of payment to the plaintiff that this doesn't have to be accord and satisfaction, that if there's, because there's this appeal pending, we'll leave open the possibility of payment of additional amounts?
It wasn't expressly raised, Your Honor, and you can look at the tender. It's in an email from my colleague, Mr. Masterson. It's document 73 in the record. That tender was made before the appeal had been filed, so it wouldn't have been in our minds that we need to raise this issue. But the tender, by its terms, is unconditional. So the tender just says, tell us where to send the check. It doesn't say we want a release. It doesn't say we want a satisfaction of judgment. It doesn't say waive your appeal rights. It is an unconditional tender. And then if you look again at that document 73, there's a later email in August from Mr. Masterson to counsel for the Robinsons. And at that point, the Robinsons had filed their appeal. I think they filed it in July. And in that second email, again, Mr. Masterson just says, where do we send the check? There is no suggestion that there are conditions attached. So this is an unconditional tender. And the Robinsons refused to accept it.
I don't know. Why does that help in your case? I mean, wouldn't a conditional tender on the second email have addressed the equitable issues that I've suggested perhaps exist?
We could have, Your Honor. I guess I don't know that there's an equities problem because, again, the unconditional nature of the tender resolves that equities problem. I shouldn't say resolves that equities problem, but makes it very clear. My client was not attaching strings to the tender. So, yes, they could have preemptively said, yes, there are no strings attached to this payment. But the fact that they didn't say there are strings attached to this payment means it's, you know, six of one, half a dozen of the other. It's the same thing. I do want to briefly speak to a couple issues that you mentioned, Judge Reyes. One is whether we're here on the merits of what the district court, whether the district court could limit post-judgment interest. The answer is no. You correctly pointed out.
Wrong?
Oh,
we are wrong.
That's the problem.
Oh, okay.
You're looking at me.
My apologies. I was confused
Judge Ross.
Yeah. You were wondering.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So you pointed out that the appellant's briefing in this matter only raise jurisdictional questions, and that's correct. If you look at their issue statement in their opening brief, they only discuss the district court's authority. So under Fontaine versus Sheen, 759 Northwest 2nd, 672 from this court in 2009, they've forfeited any kind of merits-based arguments. Judge Ross, you'd also mentioned the equities in this case. And I do want to briefly just allude to the equities. Again, we're not here on the merits, so if the court wants briefing on this issue, I'd ask to, you know, be permitted to submit a supplemental brief. But I'll just point out that the Robinsons refusing our unconditional tender and then sitting back and hoping to collect some enormous amount of post-judgment interest is grossly unfair and contrary to the purposes of post-judgment interest. So those purposes are in the Lienhard case, and I don't have the citation in front of me, but we cite this in our reply brief in support of our motion to deposit the funds.
How does the merit or lack of merit in the other appeal bear on your argument?
It doesn't. So, and actually the district court was very clear that her decision did not depend on the merits of the appeal or, on who succeeded in the Robinson.
No, I was suggesting as to your equitable argument, how does the, whether or not the appeal in the other case have merit, bear on the idea that equities fall in favor or against your client or the appellant?
Sure. My equitable argument was going to address something different. I was just going to allude to the purposes of post-judgment interest. And I don't think that those are implicated, whether or not the appeal has merit. We weren't challenging the Robinson's ability to appeal. I will point out that the district court didn't make any assumptions about who was going to win on appeal.
I guess the softball I was trying to toss up is my concern that if you're saying that by refusing the tender and allowing for extra funds to accumulate extra damages in the form of interest, if you have an appeal, you extend the length of the time that post-judgment interest can accrue.
Totally.
And if there's substantial merit, if there's substantial merit to the appeal, it perhaps matters. But if there's no merit to the appeal, perhaps it's kicking the can down the road to extend the length of time for post-judgment interest to accrue without any real legal basis to support it.
It's a fair point, Your Honor. I guess it's not one that we made to the district court, and it's I see where the equities would weigh in favor of USAA, perhaps if there had been some kind of preemptive assessment by the district court that the appeal didn't have merit. Obviously, we didn't feel that the appeal had merit. The Court of Appeals, the panel that ultimately decided it in our favor. I won't suggest that the district court needed to speculate about whether the appeal was meritorious. I do want to quickly address a misstatement of the record by Mr. French. So he indicated that Judge Hain gave no basis for her limitation of post-judgment interest. And again, we're not here on the merits, but I'll just point out this is in the hearing transcript. It's document 86 in the record, pages 3 to 4. Judge Hain explained why she was limiting post-judgment interest, and it was based on the equities. USA was being forced to incur larger amounts of post-judgment interest through no fault of its own. If there are no further questions, I'll ask the court to dismiss this matter or in the alternative, affirm the order below. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. French, you have the last word.
And I just want to say before starting with my argument that I do know Judge Ross and I do know Judge Reyes and perhaps even Judge Borkman from previous panel, so the reverse name tags didn't make any difference.
Well, the two of us are often confused because we're twins yeah. separated at birth, so we understand.
I get it. So anyways, I think the discretionary review argument fails. I think this is an acceptable appeal of an order under 103.03E. I think really, and maybe picking up from how the court is handling this, it's more on the second part of the appeal, which is, did the court have jurisdiction? And, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot. The court certainly had jurisdiction to add money to the judgment, add post-judgment interest. But I think when the judge took away money, didn't have authority to do that. And so that didn't have jurisdiction to take away money from the judgment, which post-judgment interest gets added to the judgment. In this case, a substantial part of it, I think between $1,500 and $2,000, was simply eliminated. And Judge Ross, in looking at the equities from the Robinsons' point of view, they thought they were going to win on their appeal, and perhaps it will get further review at the Supreme Court. So the appeal wasn't brought simply to get post-judgment interest. The appeal was brought because we thought that we had the right to recover additional money from USAA. There are a number of issues in this case that weren't fully litigated, and we wanted to do that. So unless the court has any questions, I have nothing further.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.